This is the one with yetis that are yetis. Yetis that aren't yetis. The first appearance of the great intelligence and some of the slowest dialogue ever performed on screen. It's called The Abominable Snowman. Here we go!
We're embarking on a voyage all through time and all through space,
counting Daleks, Thalan, Ood, and the Cybertronic race.
Sontarans look like taters, and Silurians all have wonky scales.
And the Doctor has a TARDIS, we're reviewing all his tales.
Who back when?
Reviewing all of who there is.
Who back when?
Subscribe and rate on iTunes, please.
Episode by episode, we're trudging down this temporal road. Come join us on this odyssey, what other choice could there be than who back when?
Who back when?
Hello and welcome to episode C038 of Who Back When, a Doctor Who podcast, or DocPast. I am Ponkin, yes I am, and it has been a while since I sat down to record a review for you fine people of podcast land. For those of you who don't know the dealio, here it is in, synopsized form. This is a lost serial that I'm reviewing this time around. It is The Abominable Snowman, a Patrick Troughton adventure, and as you may or may not know, lots of the classic serials, Troughton in particular, I want to say, were lost. We simply don't have them anymore. We have the audio, and there are some recons, predominantly made by Loose Cannon Productions, which are awesome, for the most part. But they are nowhere near as user-friendly to watch, delight in, and review as the fully intact serials and episodes, and as a consequence, I tend to do those as solo missions here on whobackwhen.com. This is no exception. I am doing this one on my own. If you prefer to listen to a dialogue rather than a soliloquy, a monologue, then you're in luck, buddy, because most serials are intact. Most episodes are intact, and as a consequence, I tend to do those with one or two of my fellow co-hosts. So if that's more your bag, listen to almost any other episode of Who Back When and you will be fine. Either way, if you're still listening, then, well, you're stuck with me for the next hour or so. We'll see. Here we go. Time for a bite-sized chunk of Who.
Bite-sized chunk of Who.
Doc, Jamie and Victoria arrive in 1930s Tibet, where Yetis are allegedly holding a monastery under siege, and an English professor named Travers is trying to prove their existence, even though, you know, big deal, Professor. Yetis appear to be 10 a penny around here. Doc is then promptly and wrongfully arrested for the murder of Travers' colleague and for impersonating a Yeti, while Jamie and Victoria stumble upon Yetis of their own. In fact, it seems everyone can discover Yetis around here except for the professor who's there to discover them in the first place. Anyway, hilarity ensues. B-Scow over, you are welcome. I have a whole bunch of trivia for this serial as well, but I think I might plop those bits of trivia into the review as I summarize this serial. Before we jump into it, let me just say, well, I already have said, this is a lost episode. We only have one episode at our disposal. I think it's episode 2, if memory serves. I should say, I watched the recon slash that episode quite some time ago, so I'm working off relatively old notes. I also listened to, in fact, on a number of occasions, listened to an audiobook version of this. And the audiobook is pretty good. I really enjoyed it. I will add a link to it on whobackwhen.com. As far as the recon is concerned, though, and I'm basing this solely on the fact that, some of our listeners sent in mini-reviews, and we'll get to those at the end of this episode, obviously, but one of those mini-reviews contained a reference to an animated version of a recon. Now, I did not see that. I have not seen an animated version. I am sure that if you actually even just Google it or look for it on Dailymotion, you'll probably find it. I didn't. Or rather, I didn't know about it at the time. So I watched a relatively arduous recon by Blues Cannon Productions. That being said, it is still, you know, it's worth watching. Also, before we jump into this episode, one last note. If you are a fervent listener of Who Back When, you'll know that there's sort of a Who Back When vocabulary that has grown out of these reviews. As we've progressed through the classic serials and the new Who episodes, we've come up with a vernacular of our own. And one such slang expression is the Yeti of this story. This harkens back to our review of Marco Polo, which is a William Hartnell serial, and a bloody brilliant one, by the way. That was a review that I did with fellow Who Back When co-creator, Flapjack, aka Jack Hammer, aka just Jack, if you ask him. And that was based on the fact that we thought that we encountered a Yeti in that serial. In fact, I still maintain to this day that there is a fucking Yeti in, like, just 5 or 10 minutes into episode one of Marco Polo. But some of our listeners have since then pitched in, they've chimed in and said, you know what, that's not a Yeti, that's just a dude in a coat. But because, at least at the time, we thought, well, this is a Yeti, and that Yeti then just promptly disappears and is never referred to ever again throughout the entire serial or subsequent serials, whenever anything would appear on Doctor Who that would then be discarded for the rest of the plot, we would refer to it as the Yeti of this serial. And that being said, now we're in an actual serial with honest to God Yetis, sort of. I don't want to spoil anything, we'll get to that in a bit. So it feels like we've almost come full circle. This is an important moment in Who Back When history. We're actually reviewing Yetis. Anyway, let's see if they are the Yeti of this story. We'll get to it when we get to it. Let's jump into this bad boy now. It's a 6-episode arc. We will jump into episode 1. And we open, literally, on a scream. No messing about here. No time to lose. Let's get straight into the horror. Professor Edward Travers is awoken on his campsite by said scream, originating from his colleague or campsite buddy or whatever, as the latter is being murdered by a great big hairy beastie that, the title of this serial will have us believe, is a Yeti. It turns out, by the way, and I think we find out about this later on, that Travers and his companion were in fact there to discover the Yetis. Travers is like the not at all ridiculed authority on Yetis, and seems to know a lot about them, even though he's never been in the area before, as far as I understand, has never actually seen a Yeti, and seems to me like a little bit of a nutbar. And we have some trivia right out of the gate. Professor Travers is played by Jack Watling, father of Deborah Watling, who played companion Victoria Waterfield, in fact, in this very serial. They will end up having appeared on Doctor Who alongside each other in 3 stories, namely this one, The Web of Fear, which is sort of a sequel to this one, and a direct-to-video one called Downtime, which I will be referring to a little bit later on as well. Anyway, the creature kills his buddy, grabs Travers' gun and bends it into a pretzel. Travers bolts for the hills, and hey presto, sometime later, somewhere near, the TARDIS has arrived. Doc and Co., in this case, wee little Jamie, and let's not forget Victoria of Victorian England fame, realize in no time at all that they're in the Himalayas, where Doc has been before. In fact, he has a souvenir from his last visit somewhere in the TARDIS, a bell of sorts called the Holy Ganta, which his companions retrieve for him, along with a giant Yeti-esque fur coat. Wonder if that'll, you know, come into play in a little bit. While they're looking, companions that is, Doc steps outside and immediately discovers a gigantic set of footprints that could only belong to the titular snowmen, n'est-ce pas? So he pops back in the TARDIS, grabs the Ganta, now retrieved by his loyal companions, and makes his way to the nearby Death's End Monastery, where he got the Ganta in the first place, presumably in some adventure that we will never learn about ever, ever. Fun fact, trivia fans, there is in fact no Doctor Who story out there covering the Doc's first, or in any event prior, adventure at the Death's End Monastery. However, there is a novel, again entitled Downtime, presumably the novelization of said direct-to-video spin-off, in which Victoria later revisits the Death's End in 1984. Yada yada yada. Doc tells his companions to stay put while he wanders off, which he does, and obviously they don't give half a toss about his orders and leave the TARDIS as well. So now Doc is wandering through the snow towards the monastery, coming upon the introductory murder scene and Travers' dead amigo. And Jamie and Victoria are brandishing a sword to protect themselves from whatever made those huge footprints that they really ought to view as reason enough to remain in the TARDIS. So, Doc finally gets to the monastery, no hassle there, and is immediately, well, he's arrested by the monks and Travers, who's now there, and who all assume that, A, since he's wearing his huge coat, it wasn't in fact a Yeti, but he who killed Travers' homeboy, and B, that the Doc is a total nincompoop because he's brought Travers' sac magique and bent out of shape rifle for Time Lord knows what reason, by the way, which they take to be irrefutable evidence of his guilt. Here we meet Chris Ong, by the way. Ugh. Here we meet Chris Ong. Pardon my pronunciation. He is the head monk guard or soldier or whatnot who is totes convinced that Doc is trouble, and who is also, in fact, the pasty English chap portraying a non-English character who gets Doc Hammer arrested. Kablamo! Doctor Who connection alert, Norman Jones, who played Chris Ong, again, pardon my pronunciation, he would later return in the Pertwee adventure, Doctor Who and the Silurians, and the Tom Baker serial, The Mask of Mandragora, as Major Baker and Hieronymus, respectively. So all pretty wicked. I'm sure I'll rediscover this trivia when we review all of those serials, by the way. And it'll be like, hey, you know that dude, Major Baker? He was played by the chap who portrayed Chris Song in that serial I reviewed on my own 17 years ago. And then there'll be standing ovations and I'll receive a knighthood and T-Rexes and bikinis will fan me with palm leaves as a steady flow of vodka martinis and Haribos are brought to me. Yeah, I think that trivia will carry more oomph in retrospect. Shazam! Cutting back to Jamie and Vic. They've done the smart thing and have followed the footprints to a cave that looks like the Himalayan rock equivalent of Rape Alley. It's not merely a natural cave, though, as it's clearly supported by man-made wooden beams. So we know there's some kind of human intervention here. And because they're bonkers schizoids, our humble companions enter the cave, and once inside, dum-dum-dum, they watch in horror as a big F-off clawed paw seals the cave shut with a gigantic boulder. And because reasons, they head deeper into the cave. Who knows, perhaps believing that they'll find an alternate exit. Actually, that makes perfect sense. Yeah, yeah. Back at Monkery HQ, meanwhile, the Dockmeister now learns who Travers is. I may have spoiled this earlier already. Travers is here to discover the Yeti, whom he, for some unspoken reason, is convinced reside nearby. Has been looking for them for ages with no success, even though it took Jamie and Vic, like, no time at all to stumble upon the creatures in question. And he believes that Doc is a journalist slash competing scientist, there to sabotage his feeble attempt at anthropological research, as he looks for
the Yeti! The abominable snowmen!
Travers and the Munkaroonies are totes malotes in siege mode right now, because the Yetis have been continuously harassing the monastery for some time now. Interestingly, Doc claims to have encountered Yeti before, though, and explains to Travers that they're in fact docile, peaceful creatures. You know, that they mean no harm whatsoever. Shazam! I looked this up and could find no reference to Yetis encountering a younger Doctor. In fact, the only occasion I can think of would be the quote-unquote Yeti that William Hartnell and company may or may not have encountered in episode 1 of Marco Polo that I mentioned before. But, yeah. As I said, as some of our listeners have pointed out, that may just have been a Mongol in a coat. Anyway, trying to avoid sounding a little bit too racist there. Yetis will return in Doctor Who later on. Boom! They show up in comic form in Yonder, the Yeti. On TV, in The Web of Fear. In prose and TV form, in Eye of the Gorgon, and later again, in 9 different forms. I shit you not, ladies and gentlemen, in the novel, The Taking of Planet 5. But those all take place later on in the Doctor's life, so, you know, perhaps there's room for a prequel, is what I'm saying. Whatevs. Chris Ong, G.I. Joe, is making no sense outside. He's talking to some other Munkaroonies about how Travers must be right about the Doctor's guilt, because
we have the word of the Englishman.
But what the shit, G.I. Joe? For all you know, the Doctor's an Englishman as well, so why would you doubt his word? Makes no sense. Anyway, the other monks G.I. Joe is chatting with agree with him that Dockeroony is to be brought before the abbot of the monastery ASAP. But as soon as they've left, we learn that G.I. Joe is a massive shit nozzle because he wants the Doc brought before him instead. Cut to the end of the episode, and to the abominable Cave of Infinite Terror, where Jamie and Victorian Victoria find a bunch of silver spheres that, spoiler alert, are going to factor in later on, and, dum-dum-dum, a Yeti attacks them. End of episode 1. Have I already done 2 dum-dum-dums so far in this review? I need to hold back a bit. Can't be doling out dum-dum-dums willy-nilly. Episode 2. This ep and the next can probably be sped through pretty easily. Still in the cave, the Yeti's attack is going on. We see the great big lumbering ball of fur now as well. Check out the screenshots on whobackwhen.com, ladies and gentlemen. Very, very cool. And I should say, by the way, when JD, super-duper stupendous and marvellous whobackwhen listener Gina Guerrero and I went to the 50th anniversary convention at the Excel in London, we saw an actual, honest-to-God, straight-up Yeti costume there. It was bombastically fantastic. Actually, you know what? I might, fuck it. I'm going to embed a photo of that Yeti on this page of whobackwhen.com as well. So check that out. Anyway, so we see it now. And it is vicious and strong as balls, breaking Jamie's sword in twine and causing quite a fuss. But Victoria and Jamie, henceforth referred to as Vag, cause a cave-in, grab a silver ball thingy by the, well, ball, and get the S out of D. Kablamatron! We're back in Monkery HQ, where G.I. Joe has sent another monk, Tominy, let's call him Captain No Balls, to fetch Dockmeister. Captain No Balls is easier to manipulate than the others, though, and Doc manages to actually have a chat with the fellow. He insinuates that he was at the Detson Monastery some 300 years earlier. Doc, that is. And just as Chris Ong enters, Chris Ong, that's, oh, fucking hell. I need to be more consistent about this. Chris Ong is G.I. Joe. Just as Chris Ong, oh, I did it again. Just as G.I. Joe enters to interrupt them, he also hints, Doctor this is, oh my God, I'm really confusing matters. G.I. Joe enters, interrupting them. As he does so, the Doctor, see, now it's more of a linear plotline here. The Doctor hints at proof of his divine influence and good-natured persona to be hidden under his mattress. Which it is, because after G.I. Joe has left with the Dockmeister, Captain Knowballs looks under the mattress and finds, wait for it, the Holy Ganta. And Captain Knowballs is like, Holy Ganta, Batman, and starts praying to it, effing pronto. Instead of turning around and proving to G.I. Joe that he's a lump of shit and arguing that the Doc must obviously be some sort of eternal being of perpetual light, or, you know, a super scoundrel and thief who'd stolen the Holy Ganta, Batman, and no doubt returned to Monkery HQ to commit yet more sinister crimes. Either way, it's worth mentioning, Captain Knowballs. Worth mentioning. So Doc's now meant to be used as bait to lure the Yeti into a trap set by G.I. Joe, and instead of preventing this from happening, Captain Knowballs, who's now done praying, takes the Holy Ganta, Batman, to the Abbot, and, pardon my French, fuck me, this is some of the most annoying dialogue I have encountered on Doctor Who to date. Not so much in terms of content, but rather in terms of delivery. The Abbot, Songston, I'll think of a name for him later, is chatting with the almighty leader of the monastery, Padmasambhava. Let's call him Padme Amidala. In the slowest, least inspiring, most infuriatingly unaffected way conceivable. Here, have a soundbite.
200 years or more, it has been lost to us. How came you by it?
It is the master, Padmasambhava.
I mean, the way they speak is so off-putting. It's so slow and monotone. It's like the writer couldn't think of enough things to say and just handed in a fraction of what the director expected, and consequently the direction for this scene was, you know what, just make these words last you 10 minutes. Shit me, I'd rather listen to the Rachnos Queen hiss at me for an hour than have these two slow-mos drone on. Blurg. And also, Doctor Who connection alert, times two, one of which is, like, totes amaze. So for those of you out there who are spanking it to this review, try to time your climax, so that's that piece of trivia. Numero uno, Charles Morgan, who played Songston, would later return as the Gold Usher in The Invasion of Time with Tom Baker's Fourth Doctor. Okay, cool. I can dig it. Numero dos, hold on to your bonus because this is pretty badass. Padmasambhava, aka Padme Amidala, was played by Wolf Morris, who, oddly, had previously appeared in a Hammer horror flick called The Abominable Snowman, singular, which starred, wait for it, speed up those strokes, Peter Cushing. Holy shit, Doctor Who himself. Ah, sweet relief. 3 to 5 of you just came. Or should I say of us? For the record, I'm not pleasuring myself by recording this. But with trivia that circular and coincidental, would I even have to? Moving on. I realise I haven't said anything about their appearance. Songston, that's the Abbot, is like unashamedly white. There are some actors in the cast portraying ancillary Monkaroonies who appear to not be white dudes in racist makeup. And then there are other actors who are practically in blackface, like the dude who plays G.I. Joe. He's a white guy with shoe polish on his face and a massive fake handlebar mustache. It could hardly be more offensive. Songston, though, he must have appeared on set on day one and just gone, you know what, guys, I think I'm just going to be a white dude. And because Charles Morgan swung such massive star power, no one dared object. Ditto Padme Amidala. He's also mega pasty, but like mega pasty because he's also meant to be this ancient and dusty character, I suppose. Anyway, they have their boring conversation for an hour and a half until Captain Knowballs arrives with the Holy Ganta Batman and finally, thankfully, interrupts them. Transpires, Padme Amidala knows the Doctor from his last visit to the Death's End Monastery, but doesn't want him to know he's still there, for fear of the Doctor ruining their, quote, great plan. So, A, Padme Amidala must be either over 300 years old or a fellow time traveller, right? And B, he's clearly a shifty MFer with an ulterior motive. Paradoxically, however, Amidala and the Abbot, really need a name for him, MIB Captain Knowballs's memory and send him on his way, but only after the Abbot, yet to be renamed, orders him to free the Dockmeister and make sure that he's unharmed. But why? Spoiler alert, seriously, if you don't want to hear this yet, then for the next 20 seconds, you know, earmuffs. Padme Amidala is an intergalactic, shit-spackled bad guy, whom we'll encounter in New Who even. He's seriously bad news, and most def, an enemy of the Doctor's. Well, this is his chance to kill him. Just don't save the Doctor, let him die instead. Freeing him at this juncture makes no goddamn sense, and yes, I know this is the kind of argument that we make in about half of the Doctor Who serials and standalone episodes that we review on Who Back When, and probably about all of the Dalek ones, but shit, man, really? It's as though the Doctor has made it to over a millennium in age, not by virtue of being clever, but because his foes are such massive cockhats. And it's not like the Abbot and Padme actually want him to stick around. They even say that he needs to leave ASAP, or they'll make him leave. So freaking let him die and be rid of the whole problem. Jeez, bad guys. Ugh. Righto. I said I'd speed this one up. Perhaps I'll speed through the next one instead. Let's wrap up episode 2 quickly first. Okay, Vaj bump into Professor Travers, who first points a gun at them, threatens to kill them, and then turns 180 and goes, oh, you know where there are Yetis? Rad, let's be best friends, and yes, I'll free the Doc as well if you show me where you found him. So, to Monkery HQ they go. Doc is freed by Travers at the same time as he is freed by Captain Nobles as per the orders of Padme Amidala, and the Abbot, who is yet to be named. And Vaj, show him. Vaj. They show him, the Doctor I mean, the aforementioned silver ball. Shazam! Three Yetis approach menacingly. Holy shit, think Doc and Vaj. But turns out Jamie has a plan to capture one of them, which obviously is going to be really tough. Cut to Jamie capturing a Yeti in a net. Not with goat bait or a fur magnet or whatever. With a fucking net. Problem solved. The Yeti collapses, the other two Yetis leave, and we end the episode on Doc identifying the captured Yeti as... Screw it, this merits another one. Dum-dum-dum! Not a Yeti, but a robot. And as though that weren't enough, the silver gonad that Vaj brought back and then stupidly left back in the temple somewhere starts rolling on its own accord, allegedly in the direction of the collapsed Yeti. End of episode 2! Episode 3. Don't really remember what happened in episode 3, to be honest with you, and my notes on it are pretty sparse. The important bits are that suspicions are running high in Monkery HQ, and practically everyone changes their mind. Ugh, how many anyways is that so far, by the way? The monks who previously believed Travers to be a respectable Englishman now suspect that he is controlling the robot Yetis. The monks who previously distrusted the Doc Hammer, e.g. G.I. Joe, now think he's a cheerful good guy. The Doc Meister, who was recently S&M'd by G.I. Joe et al., and who legitimately should be thinking, screw these mofos, is now thinking, man, they're swell. And Captain Nobles, though this is merely inferred, proves he has balls and wants to use them because he suddenly buddies up to Victorian Victoria. We do also learn who is controlling the robot Yetis, though. It's Padme Amidala, and I'm pretty sure this is also where at some point during the 10 minutes of expository slow-motion dialogue between him and Songston, who still needs a nickname, we learn that Padme Amidala is in fact none other than the Great Intelligence. That's amazing. This is the first appearance of the Great Intelligence, a foe whom, as you know, we'll encounter throughout Doctor Who, classic and new. Many, many times. The last time we did, I think, the Great Intelligence jumped from the great giant snow globe of infinite wisdom into Richard E. Grant, where E stands for Withnail. Have you seen Withnail and I, by the way? One of my favourite films ever. My buddy Rico and I would watch it about once a month for a year, to the point where we knew it by heart and had, like, overanalyzed every scene in it. So do yourselves a favour and watch it. Okay, so anyway. Another anyway. Ugh. The Great Intelligence, aka Padme Amidala, is controlling the Yetis, and he's doing so using what is pretty cool and totally moronic at the same time. Namely, a giant map with recognizable by effing anyone Yeti avatars on it. It looks like General Schwarzkopf moving pieces around a map. I like that part of it. But he's intelligent. And great, right? So why would he need that board? Why would he take the risk of being discovered? Come to think of it, why does he even need the robot Yetis? Fuck, it just dawned on me that I don't know what the bad guy's plan is. Does he have one? Did I just miss it? Or is this terribly poor writing? Perhaps it'll become clear. God damn it! Whatevs. Doc and Jamie head back to the TARDIS to fetch some equipment, and as soon as they leave frame, we get some pretty hot ball action now. We see a couple of Yeti robots fetching a silver ball outside and then walking away, because the reason the Yeti fell unconscious before it transpires is because it literally dropped the ball. Literally. And then the silver ball in the temple rolls all the way into the captured Yeti, thus reactivating it, which I think you'll agree with me is pretty fantastic. Anyway, we close the... Shit, was that another anyway? We close this episode on said awakened Yeti attacking Victorian Victoria and her new would-be boyfriend, Captain Nobles. End of episode 3. Episode 4. Boom! The now fully conscious, not Yeti, Nyeti. Oh my god. Nyeti! I nailed it. Are you kidding me? I'm so proud of myself. Everyone take 5. That was inspired. Okay. I'm okay. I'm okay. The Nyeti full-on Raftars out of Monkery HQ. Nothing the monks can throw its way will stop it. Spears? Nuh-uh. Swords? Forget about it. Before they know it, the Nyeti is out of there. God, I love Nyeti. And where does it go but the Cave of Infinite Bollocks, where it bros down with Songston, who still doesn't have a nickname. This is where I'm a little confused, though, because as far as I can remember, and TARDIS Wikia actually confirms this, Padme Amidala is possessed by the Great Intelligence. As in, the Great Intelligence is actually a separate entity altogether, but just as Withnail was taken over by the Snow Globe in Matt Smith times and thus became the Great Intelligence, or vice versa, you get what I'm saying, just like that, Padme Amidala is the Great Intelligence, right? But what happens next is that Padme starts chatting with the GI, Great Intelligence, as though they're separate again. But they're one, so how is that possible? Shit snacks, I don't know, doesn't matter. The GI and or Padme Amidala announces that the Great Experiment is about to begin, which rings a nasty bell since we literally just reviewed Daleks in Manhattan, where they have about 15 different final experiments. We don't find out what the Great Experiment is just yet, though, will we? I cannot remember. Either way, Songston, aka Mr. Apparently Doesn't Merit a Nickname, does some sci-fi hocus-pocus and pops a metal pyramid inside a cave. It starts to glow. We understand that something pretty great and experimental is going down. And then he gets the S out of D. Professor Travers of... Wait, does he also not have a nickname fame? Watches and moves into the cave on his own. What a clown! He watches as the pyramid glows and grows even, and then finally makes a terrifying noise that sends him running for the hills. The pyramid, that is. As in... Fucking hell. The pyramid makes a terrifying noise. He runs for the hills. You understand what I'm saying. You're smart people. Meanwhile, DJ, that's Doc and Jamie, arrive at the TARDIS, only to find access to it blocked by another Nieti. Doc lobs a rock at it, and we realize that it's powered down, like R2 between Jedi Returning and The Force Awakening. Second Star Wars reference, I know, but I recently rewatched Episode 7, so it's fresh in my mind. Shazam! Doc removes its control sphere thingy and pops into the TARDIS to get his equipment, but suddenly the sphere starts acting all berserk. And we get a good bit of sci-fi mumbo-jumbo from the Doc Hammer explaining that the spheres recharge inside the Nieti's chest vaginas, which isn't really important. Moving on. Back at Monkery HQ, shit is going down. G.I. Joe blames Captain No-Balls for the Nieti escaping, and he, that is Captain No-Balls and Victoria and Victoria, are thrown in jail for being bad guys. So, to clarify, this is moments after they were deemed good guys by G.I. Joe, moments after they were deemed bad guys, largely by G.I. Joe. This dude needs to make up his mind. Yada yada yada. Now that they're in jail, Victoria and Victoria tells Captain No-Balls that the Doc Hammer visited Monkery HQ 300 years earlier. And Captain No-Balls is like, cool, no biggie, man, because guess what? Padme Amidala is, like, totes officially, quote, liberated from body and time, unquote. Speaking of, Padme tells Songston, who's now back in Monkery HQ, that the GI is taking on corporeal form, and I go, what the F is happening? I mean, yeah, sure, isn't Padme the GI's corporeal form? I am super duper confused. Anyway, that's what's happening, and Padme tells all the other Monkaroonies to shit off, which they pretty much refuse to do. Action time! I am bullet pointing this ep from now on. Blam! DJ narrowly evade Nieti capture in the hills. Shazam! Victoria great escapes out of the cell but leaves Captain No-Balls locked inside because I don't remember why. Kablamo! DJ return to Monkery HQ and become BFFs with G.I. Joe because G.I. Joe thinks Padme's order to get the Monkaroonies to shit off is massively shicer. Bing bong! Travers returns to HQ as well and is totes uber bonkers. He's gone full Kardashian and is just ranting about a glowing pyramid and making no sense whatsoever. Antepenultimate bullet point noise! Did you think DJ were free and easy? Guess again, gringo, because now they're imprisoned instead. Penultimate bullet point noise. Padme orders more Nietis into the monastery. And final bullet points. Boom! Shazam! Kablamatron! Victoria meets Padme Amidala, and he is, as discussed earlier, wait for it, an old white guy. End of episode 4. Episode 5. Victoria sees Padme's Yeti board game, but it doesn't mean wiener, because Padme Men in Blacks her and just sends... for even more Nietis, and now they're freaking pouring into the compound, and then all of a sudden the Nieti are ordered out of the compound, and they pour back out, killing a Monkaroonie in the process. So that plot point, them arriving I mean, is pretty much just instantly reversed. Makes no sense. Padme Amidala is not super pleased by this, and now chit-chats with the GI again, who tells him to, you know, 187 the Doc Hammer. Ugh, let's bullet point some more. Boom! Travers awakens and his totes malotes fine in the noggin again. Blam! Victorian Victoria, is now under the spell of Padme Amidala and or the GI and tells the other monks to F off. And then DJ are freed and Doc seeks out Padme Amidala because Captain No-Ball says Padme's an old friend of his from 300 years back. And he's probably thinking, ah, dude owes me some money. Cut to Padme Amidala, who's chit-chatting with the GI about having helped it bring the world to its end. That is a quote. Shazam! Dockmeister cockblocks Padme and G.I., and we learn that the G.I. was this shapeless galactic energy that arrived in the Himalayas, took over Padme's body, exactly right, and forced him to conduct some sort of experiment, which it turns out was intended to end the world, as I understand it. But what the fuck? The G.I. has been in the monastery for over 300 years. It was there the last time Doc stopped by, and the experiment literally only just started. We heard it start. Is it already over? What the shit did they wait 300 years for? It's not like anything crucial happened during that time. They built the Nyetis, so what? They put a pyramid thing in the cave. Big whoop, Padme, that took Songston like 5 minutes. What the hell did you do with the other 32 years, 11 months, 30 days, 23 hours and 55 minutes? Fuck! We never find out. And what is the experiment? To see whether the Yetis can be manipulated into fighting for the GI? Dude, we already knew that! This bad guy plan might as well have been constructed by Daleks for how goddamn stupid it is. Oh, Jesus, it's so frustrating. This must be the only time in television history that Tibetan monks are portrayed as massive idiots. Yawn. Anyway, the GI kills Padme as he's revealing all of this to the Doc, and Doc dashes back out to counter Derren Brown Victoria out of her Padme trance, and just then, as though his freaking hair's been voodoo washed by freaking Melisandre, freaking Padme freaking wakes up again. Ugh, potential spoiler for a very popular show there. Blam! End of the episode coming up now. Travers and Doc come upon a bunch of Yetis and realize they're being controlled from inside the monastery when Travers suddenly remembers the pyramid in the cave. Will that pan out? Nope. And we end the episode on said cave and said pyramid where the GI is taking on physical form. What? But I thought, I mean, what about Padme? Ugh, cock it. End of episode 5. Episode 6, the final episode. You know what? Before we start this one, let me just Google Songston and see if I can find an appropriate nickname for this MFer online. Because I've looked inside my brain hole and all I got out of that was a wooden-toothed old lady with a bad eye and kimchi breath giving me the finger. Blam! I'm back. Just Googled him. Now I'm thinking I got the name wrong. Maybe it's not Songston, but Song Tsen. Check this out. Quote from Wikipedia. Song Tsen Gampo was the founder of the Tibetan Empire and is traditionally credited with the introduction of Buddhism to Tibet. Whoa. Point is, that's a big deal. I don't want to mess with that. So, Big Deal has now succumbed to the manipulative powers of G.I. as well, but G.I. Joe, not to be confused with G.I., arrives and tries to stop him, but Big Deal, flipping Bruce Lee's G.I. Joe in the neck with an iron fist. Boom. Man down. More confusion coming up. Padme Amidala begs the GI to let him go, but newsflash, dude, Meister, Padme effing died. Like, Padme had ceased to be. Padme had rung down the curtain and joined the Choir Invisible. Padme was an ex-parrot. So what the shit? I thought the GI just got Padme's body all to himself. Makes no sense. Whatever. Okay, so speeding through this now, I've spent way too much time on this serial already. Here's what happens. All the monks now know that Big Deal is a shit gobbler, and set out to kill the hell out of him. Probs as revenge for Big Deal breaking G.I. Joe's throat, right? Doc convinces them to spare him, though, saying both he and Padme Amidala are under the influence of some higher, more sinister power. It est the G.I. It est the Great Intelligence. And most of the Monkaroonies leave Monkery HQ instead. So now we've got Team Good Guys comprising Doc Hammer, Vag, and Captain No-Balls, and Team Bad Guys comprising Not Big Deal, Not Padme, the G.I., and a nut-ton of Nyetis. Travers, meanwhile, pops into the ball cave to destroy the shit out of the pyramid. Which he does he? I'm not sure he does. We then get a bunch of exposition as Doc gets his hands on Big Deal, and he, under hypnotic suggestion, explains what's going on. Here's basically what he says. The G.I. made Padme Amidala ostensibly immortal, and over the course of, like, 200 years, 250 years, whatever, they built all of the Nyetis. By they, I'm assuming they mean Padme Amidala, right? Because the GI is just this energy blob. So, over the course of 200-something years, Padme Amidala built all the Nyetis. Okay, so far I suppose that's a solid plan. What did the GI want, though? Like, what? Explain to me. Here's what he wanted. He wanted total command of the cave. What? Way to think big, GI. And then later on, the GI apparently got greedy and decided it wanted control of the whole mountain instead. Wait, a mountain? First a cave, then a mountain. Wait, one second. Let me see how best to frame this. What the fuck, Great Intelligence? You were a legit intergalactic energy monster. think big, stay in space, a mountain, let alone a cave? That's not a step up, dude. I just don't get it, man. I think I've given up on you. Anyway, 83rd anyway of this episode, I reckon. Big Deal reveals that the Nieti control is behind Padme's throne. Victorian Victoria also gets some Tibetan kryptonite in the form of a prayer to protect her from GI hypnosis, and not just any prayer, but the Jewel of the Lotus prayer. Bullet point time again. Boom. Travis is finding it difficult to scale the mountain and reach the cave because the mountainside is covered in this gloopy, barfy splooge. Not kidding. I'm not sure what it is, but clearly the Nietis came all over the place. Shazam! The monastery turns into a massive cage fight. Doc and Vaj confront Padme Amidala. Kapow! Padme hypnotizes Victoria, who can't resist despite her Jewel of the Lotus prayer, because why? Because she's a woman, that's why. It's 1967. What can I say? We've had this conversation before on Who Back When. Sexism. Yada yada yada, enough said. Blam! Jamie destroys some silver gonads. No dice, says Amidala. Razzmatazz! Jamie then finds another pyramid thingy. In the temple. Not in the cave. And he destroys that. And kerblammo, the freaking mountain blows its lid. That's not even hyperbole. The mountain turns into a champagne cork. Padme and or GI disintegrate into a screaming mess. And the good guys win. So we didn't even need the cave. And all that Nieti splooge was for naught, because there was a perfectly destructible pyramid in the temple. Whatever. Captain Nobles heads off to fetch his Munkaroony buddies, and just as the good guys are about to head off, Travers can only think of his career and goes, "Shit, you guys, I didn't find a single Yeti, just a bunch of Nietis." When, wait for it, a real, honest-to-God, salt-of-the-earth Yeti, not a Nieti, an actual Yeti, stops by, and Professor Travers plops off, one presumes, to either kill it or capture this poor docile creature in order to subject it to social ridicule and inhumane experiments. Doc and Vaj, TARDIS away. End of The Abominable Snowman.
Review.
Okay, I think I pretty much sped through that one, actually, now that I think about it. What am I saying? I have no idea what I'm talking. I have no idea what I'm talking. Yes, that is monotransitive. No, it's not. Fuck. Oh, ignore me, people. All right, so there are some things that I love about this serial and other things that I really cannot stand. Start with the plus column. The Great Intelligence shows up for the first time in Doctor Who. That is pretty epic. It's a shame that the GI is such a massive idiot in this one, and that his plan makes so little sense. But what does it matter, really? We have the Great Intelligence for the first time. And I'll be honest with you, I didn't know. I could not remember that the Great Intelligence was a classic foe. I thought it was a new one. I am mesmerized. I am razzmatazzed by that. Troughton fits into the plus column here as well. He's clever and hysterical. I get much of the same vibe from him here that I got in Power of the Daleks. Liking it. The setting, too, is a major turn-on for me. Himalayas? Awesome. Tibetan Monastery? Behold my boner. But my biggest bonus point, as in the major reason I'm marking the serial up, is the conflagration of sci-fi elements it has to offer. We have the Nietis! I mean, God, I love that name. I mean, seriously, you think there are Yetis? Yeah, rad, that's already something I'd expect to find in a Doctor Who serial. But then, what's that? They're not Yetis? They're robots posing as Yetis? Well, I'll be blown by an alligator's hand puppet. That is effing crazy balls. Awesome. Plus points. Another sci-fi element. What about the balls? How cool were they, right? Remote control silver gonads that need to recharge inside robot chests? That shit is awesome. Minus column. What the hell were those silver gonads good for, though? And the pyramid? Pyramids? Plural? Why was there one pyramid and ball dealio going on in the cave when there was another perfectly good pyramid and ball dealio in the monastery? Did they connect in some way? Did they have to coexist? Why separate them? What good was that cave for at all? And what was the mountain splooge? Seriously, who shot their load on the mountain? We don't find out. This serial casts such a wide net of science fiction tropes, so ahead of its time in some cases, and some of those tropes make it so well, but others just fall by the wayside. I feel like there's maybe just a little bit too much going on for all of it to work. And what about the bad guy plan? A cosmic energy cloud that wants to branch out and live in a cave, but then go, screw that nonsense, I want a whole mountain? What? I don't get it. I just don't get it. And what was the great experiment? I feel like we're in Daleks in Manhattan again. What was it? And was it successful? I have no idea what the Great Intelligence was after here. Literally no idea whatsoever. I'm guessing that the novel, open bracket, Azation, close bracket, makes more sense of it, though. And I happen to know that one of our listeners has read it, because we got a mini review coming up, spoiler alert. But we'll get to it when we get to it. What else can I say? The companions. In episodes 1 to 2, I really thought Vaj were going to... that they were going to have more action and agency, but in the end, they sort of blended into the background. As for the other characters, ugh, whatever. G.I. Joe looks mega racist. The only actual non-white cast member had like two lines of dialogue and was, I think, the one who got killed off. I can't really remember now. Sane Travers was all right, but mental. Insane raving Travers was totally goddamn bonkers in his brain hole. Loved it. All right, end of the day, I'm giving this serial... I'm giving it a 3.4 because I think Troughton is awesome. I love some of the sci-fi elements. I even really appreciate that they made an effort and tried to cram even more sci-fi into this episode than they, or into the serial, than they managed to pull off. And yes, exactly. So A for effort, 3.4.
Listener minis.
And we have a whole bunch of listener minis. I'm going to go through them in chronological order. As in the order in which they were sent in. We're going to start off with... surprise, surprise. This one comes from SGamer82. Steven. Oh, it feels good to sing that song again. Steven goes, this is the one that taught me how to pronounce Padmasambhava. The Abominable Snowman is our first appearance of the Great Intelligence, a foe that has become quite familiar to modern-day Whovians. No shit. Awesome. Yes, true. He goes on. This is one of the stories I actually read the novelization to a long time ago. Unfortunately, real-life obligations prevented me from finding time to reread it. Even re-listening to the episode audiobook was a bit more disjointed than I'd have liked, so this will be briefer than my usual review. Time and memory permitting, I'll probably add any interesting extras or differences to my review on the site later when I can reread. Looking forward to it, buddy! Looking forward to it! He goes on. Sorry, I'm high on caffeine. All right, here we go. Steven goes on. For now... I can say that I did enjoy the episode, though it did have a few of the tropes we've come to associate with this era, like the hostile military man, Chrisong, who does more harm than good in hindering the Doctor. He at least does better than most and realizes he can't handle the Yeti. We arguably have two such characters, given Travers' initial hostility to the troop. Victoria had more agency than before, I think, as well. So much so even, her own allies had to lock her up to keep her from getting into trouble. Interesting. I wonder if maybe you're thinking of the novel there. Maybe I'm just misremembering. Either way, interesting point. He goes on. At the same time, the Doctor doesn't even try to argue when Victoria refuses to leave at the end. The intelligence was an interesting foe, using mental control and hypnosis to move its pieces across the board, and the final confrontation with it, at least in audiobook form, had a sense of desperation I don't think we've ever really had in Doctor Who. Yes, good point. I... really just glazed over that in this review. Apologies. Very good point. Humor-wise, Stephen goes on, I would say my favorite point comes when the Doctor and Jamie are faced with inert Yeti and Jamie asks what the Doctor has in mind, expecting some grand plan, only for the Doctor to take a page from the Tower of Vicky. He observed, noted, collated, concluded, then bunged a rock at it. The biggest downside to my mind is that it reused the gimmick from the Macra Terror, where a major antagonist was a never-seen, unquestioningly obeyed leader. Before it was the Macra through the colony controller, here it's the intelligence through the Padmasambhava, and him through the Abbot or Victoria. Because I couldn't listen to it as I would have liked, I may be rating lower than it deserves, but my final rating on The Abominable Snowman is a 3.2. No, I think that's a very, very fair rating, Stephen. Awesome. Thank you very much for sending in your mini. And just a super-duper quick comment, because we've got a lot of minis to cover in this episode. I love the fact that you've made a reference to other hostile military men. I had not thought about that. We get that in a lot of serials. We got that in... was it Moonbase? Was it Moonbase? It wasn't Moonbase. Shit, now I'm misremembering. We got it in the first Cyberman one. What was that one called? 10th Planet, that's what it was called. We had the same there. We have it. I don't even have to name check episodes. We have that almost across all of the ones with humans in them. Is that fair to say? I wonder if that's fair to say. In fact, we get that in a lot of New Who as well. Regardless, awesome point. Love it. Ladies and gentlemen of podcast land, are you following the Steve Meister on Twitter? You definitely should. He is at SGamer82. That is 82, the number. Thanks, Steven. Next mini review comes from Chris. Maybe that song needs a little bit of polishing. Sorry, Chris. Right. Chris goes, so I've read The Abominable Snowman by Terence Dix, and this serial makes a lot more sense. Yes, thank you very much, Chris. Holy smokes. We've got two listeners so far who have read the novel. Awesome. Okay, and I guess this as well, that it would make more sense if, like, there's just more content. All right, here's what Chris says. First off, I would like to note that this was the first of the Target novelizations, and I quite liked it. As a sidebar, I wonder if there will ever be a literary Who review from Who Back When. I was able to read this in about 4 hours. Think about it, Punkin. I am thinking about it, Chris. Terence Dix, he goes on, also gave some additional explanations about the past of the Great Intelligence, which wasn't featured in the TV serial. He was from another universe and only stumbled upon Earth through hearing the most powerful mind of Padme something Vader. Vader? Vada? Vader. It's how I heard it in the serial, and I couldn't hope to pronounce the spelling. He says, Padmasambhava. So that's my nickname. I like it. Padma something Vader. And yes, we've actually talked about this quite recently because someone, sorry, this is a little bit of a tangent and an incredibly rude interruption. I apologize, Chris. But we did actually talk about having a literary review on Who Back When quite recently because we were offered review copies of, I cannot remember what the book was called now, a Doctor Who novel. And also not sure if I'm allowed to say it. But we decided to skip that one because it was short notice, and as you may or may not know, I mean, I was away for like 2 months there. Sorry for the delay in dropping this episode. But either way, we will. There will be a novel review, probably as a bonus episode, though, not as like a channel. Anyway, Chris goes on. Here is what viewing the episodes looked like to me. DJV, look for a bell that Doc got the last time he visited the monastery, and gets attacked by a Yeti. Episode 2, perfect quality, no need to summarize. Then 3 through 6 gave me this information. The Yeti are robots, there is a silver ball that makes an annoying noise as it moves on its own to the Yeti. The Abaddon Padme something Vader controls the Yeti for some unknown reason, and then some fog on the mountain scares everyone and the serial ends. I gave that a 1.0 in my initial review, but the book helped greatly. Wait. Before I jump into your next paragraph, Chris, first off, that's possibly the best summary of this serial I have I've heard to date, even though I think maybe your rating is cruel. 1.0, Jesus, have a heart, man. And two, it was fog, was it really? I thought it was splooge. I thought there was like gloopy gloppy boff all over the mountain so that he would just slip and stuff. Anyway, I don't know. You read the novel, you know more about this than I do. Let's see, here we go. Chris goes on. I would now like to revise my summary. Oh, god damn it. In the serials, all I got of Travers after the first two episodes was that same still image and him talking to himself. His storyline is much more clear in the novelization. He knew full well that the Doctor hadn't attacked his friend when he made the accusation, but only did so for fear of the Doctor trying to steal his glory at finding the Yeti. Travers is the first to discover that the Abbot is involved with the Yeti when he follows the Abbot and his Yeti escort. Travers also tries to shoot Padme something Vader to to save everyone at the end, which doesn't work. Which, actually, yes, he does that in the recon as well, which I completely forgot to mention. Anyway, he goes on. Several of the monks are much more interesting than in the serials. Tomney and Victoria. Tomney, that's Captain Norbolt to you and me. Tomney and Victoria develop a strong bond as Victoria pushes Tomney's buttons about always doing what he's told, and Tomney continually trying to protect Victoria, who doesn't really want his help. Chrisong, that's G.I. Joe, has the most interesting character transformation. He goes from savagely against the Doctor to skeptical about the Doctor to going along with the Doctor. I had seen the recon of the serial several times and never understood why the Yeti and Travers were so beloved to bring them back later that season. But now I get it. Thank you, Terence Dix. One last little bit of trivia. Travers is played by Jack Watling, the real-life father of Deborah Watling. In brackets, Victoria. Yeah, I know! I said that before, weren't you listening? All right. Chris gives it a score. He says, my score for the book is 4.0, holy smokes, which averaged with my 1.0 for the recon will average my experience with The Abominable Snowman at a 2.5, and there it shall stay. Awesome mini review, Chris. That is fantastic. Super interesting. I mean, You know, I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to read this novelization. Now I've seen the serial. I've listened to it a bunch. I know the serial, and you've now summarized the differences. So I'm actually not going to read this. But it is super interesting to know, and I'm sure this also applies to other novelizations, you know, novelizations of other serials, of other Classic Who predominantly lost serials, that there's so much more like rich character development to be had and enjoyed and analyzed. So that is super interesting. Thank you very much for bringing that to our attention. If you want to follow Chris on Twitter, sorry you can't, because he didn't mention what his Twitter handle is. Chris, you the man. Next one. Here we go. We only have one more listener mini to go. It's bordering on a maxi. I'm going to read it in full. I don't give a shit. Really? You're in a hurry? Well, fine. Fast forward then. See if I care. Here we go. I will tell you, though, I did actually read this mini before pressing record. So I can tell you, spoiler alert, it's a pretty good one. So you probably don't want to fast forward through it. Whatever. Here we go. This one comes from Trenton Bless. Trenton Bless. That's Bless with two S's. Trenton goes... Here's my mini/maxi review of The Abominable Snowman. Hello, once again, Podcast Land. I'm back for a second time in a row to take a look at The Abominable Snowman. As always, says Trenton, let's begin with a quick fact file. I promise this will be much shorter this time. Actually, hang on, sorry, I'm going to interrupt you there, and I'm going to say, ladies and gentlemen of Podcast Land, go to whoback1.com and scan through the past few classic episodes or classic reviews, because Trenton has added maxi reviews to those, and they are, pardon my French, fucking spot on. They are awesome. You need to read them. So, sorry for the interruption there. Trenton goes on. Only episode 2 of this 6-part story exists in the BBC archives as a 16mm black and white film telerecording. Episode 2 was shown alongside the Web of Fear episode 1 as part of BSB's Doctor Who weekend in September 1990 under the banner of The Yeti Rarities. This was before most of Web was returned. The North Wales Mountain Pass at Nantfrancon. That's my pronunciation there. Actually, no, that's exactly how you pronounce it. That pass doubled as Tibet for the filming of this serial. Filming was done there from the 4th to the 9th of September, 1967. So pencil that into your file of faxes retroactively, Podcast Land. Sorry, another interruption there. Trenton goes on. According to Jack Watling, one of the actors playing the Yeti fell hundreds of feet during filming and was feared dead, but was merely inebriated and fortunately cushioned by the foam rubber inside the costume. And with the short fact file out of the way, let's get on with the review. If the Abominable Snowman were a stick of rock, it would have Doctor Who running through it. Few stories scream out the show's name and capture its appeal quite so precisely. Here's that list of ingredients. Unusual setting. Huge and threatening monster. Creepy malefactor. Clear storytelling. Really? And that killer concurrence of personal peril with widespread jeopardy. Other adventures fit the mould, but not with such atmosphere and ingenuity. Oh, interesting. Okay. The sad thing is that only episode 2 of the story exists. The recons I watched were good. They were in pretty good quality. Oh, not mine. God damn it, man, where did you find these? He goes on. It also helped that there were some animated portions. This is what I was talking about before. I did not see the animated bits. You saw a much better recon than I did. All right. Jesus Christ, I just keep interrupting you left, right, and center, dude. Sorry about that, man. All right. He goes on. But it doesn't really do this serial justice, does it? If there's a serial that I want more episodes of, besides the obvious ones like The Daleks' Master Plan, Power and Evil of the Daleks, it would definitely be this one. Writers Haseman and Lincoln people their landscape with compelling characters, as well as the misguided but essentially decent Travers, the monks, wrestling a clutch of hard-to-pronounce but authentic-sounding names, are nicely delineated. The best of them is Padmasambhava. It's an astonishing vocal performance by Wolf Morris as the alien-possessed Lama, switching from modulated compassion to spat-out malice. And there's something searingly gruesome about his crumpled countenance. My God, you're a very good writer, Trenton. Very good writing. Not sure I agree with the point you're making, though, because, man oh man, his vocal performance really bummed me out. All right. Trenton goes on. Another way in which this unusually lean six-parter stands out is in its lack of music. Try to imagine such an approach working in today's era of wall-to-wall scoring. Silence versus total music. There's no right or wrong answer. After all, it's the variety of approach that has kept the show running for so long. But here it enables the sound of wind whistling through the cloisters to create the mood, and for the actors to do more with their voices, as well as Morris's dual lead vocals throughout. Patrick Troughton's subtlety in talking down an entranced Victoria in episode 5 is also marvellous. It's also interesting to note that Deborah Watling's father, Jack, joined up for the serial as Professor Travers. There's an interesting story about that, actually. And he puts in quotes, "Dad and I were like mates," Deborah said. "Pat, Fraser and he got on like a house on fire. One day I lost them all and later found them at the back of the catering van having a few brandies to keep warm. I asked for one, but they said I was too young. I was only 19. Now that's a good little story, isn't it? Says Trenton. Yes, it is. And me oh my, did Deborah Watling lead a sheltered life. All right. Overall, Trenton concludes, this story is definitely classic material. It's such a shame that this serial is almost completely gone. With only the second episode intact, we only get a flavour of the Yeti here. Only a taste of the great intelligence here. But only 3 months after this serial's conclusion, the Doctor will have another encounter with these menaces, and luckily next time we can get all but a small piece of the Yeti candy bar. It's still missing bits, but we still have a majority of the candy bar. I'm going to give this story a 3.8 out of 5. It's a classic, but I can't give it too much more because of the missing episodes, and I'm not going to be as generous as I did with The Tomb of the Cybermen. Next time, the Doctor, Jamie and Victoria go from a cooler to the freezer. You'll find out what I mean. So far, the serials have been set in cold places, the ice tombs of Telos, the Himalayas, and next time another icy place. Ice seems to be the theme so far. Talk soon. Trenton, thank you for an astonishingly maxi-mini awesome... I say astonishingly, I mean astonishing and astonishingly. Ugh, you get what I'm saying. I'm paying you a compliment. I had not even considered. I'm just going to pick out one single thing here that you mentioned because, I mean, every paragraph just is mesmerizing. But one thing really stands out as something that I didn't even consider myself. And I had forgotten that I'd read about it before I pressed record. The lack of music. I didn't even consider that. That's almost revolutionary in terms of filmmaking or, you know, TV producing. TV producing? Producing TVs! I make TVs for a living. You get what I'm saying. Anyway, either way, that's pretty revolutionary. Awesome stuff. Thank you very much for pointing it out. If and when I re-listen to it, and I probably will re-listen to the audiobook at least, because it's in my iPhone and I'm too lazy to replace it with another one for a while. So, yeah, I will consider that. Awesome stuff. Thanks for your review. Ladies and gentlemen of Podcast Land, if you want to follow Trenton Bless on Twitter, you can. Guess what his Twitter handle is? Good guess. It is at Trenton Bless. That's Bless with two S's. Thanks, man. Okie dokie, that's all we've got this time around. Stay tuned for even more stuff, because that's sort of how podcasts work. Our next Classic Who review is going to be of The Ice Warriors. That's right, the introduction of Ice Warriors in the Hooniverse. Very, very cool stuff. And if I'm not mistaken, that is a largely intact serial, so I don't think I'm going to be doing that one on my own. Our next New Who review is actually going to be recorded in about 4 days' time. Yeah, it's Saturday today. We're recording it on Wednesday, the chaps and I, and it's going to be a review of Evolution of the Daleks. Be sure to listen to our review of Daleks in Manhattan before you listen to that one. I hate that episode. It's utter nonsense. I think that review is going to be fun. and our next audiobook review, or Audio Who review, is going to be The Scapegoat, which I'm not overly fond of, but, you know, it's no Wirren Dawn. Thank you so much for listening. Ladies and gentlemen of Podcast Land, why don't you high-five me on Twitter? I'm not uber-active on Twitter. But if you high-five me, I promise to high-five you back. It's a good way of asking questions. You can follow me on Twitter. I am at Ponkin. Here's a soundbite of fellow co-host JD singing how you spell that.
P-O-N-K-E-N, Ponkin.
Thanks, JD. Thanks for listening. Be right next to each other. And ciao. Who back when?
Kablamo! Did you enjoy the show? Then please do what the cosmos compels you to and spread the gospel of Who Back When. Tell your friends. Don't have any friends, no problemo. Tell some strangers. Like us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/whobackwhen, all in one word. Are you on Google Plus? Then find us on Google Plus. That's Plus Who Back When. And when you do, tell us why you're on Google Plus. Who Back When just got its very own Twitter account. No lie. So give us a follow. You guessed it. That's @WhoBackWhen, all in one word. Check us out on SoundCloud, vote us up on Reddit, listen to us on Stitcher, and head on over to our website, whobackwhen.com, where you can leave a comment, submit a review of your own, and peruse our visual index of aliens, monsters, and more, which increases in kablamos with every episode. And lastly, give us a rating and review on iTunes. Not only would it make us super chuffed, and it really, really would, but as thanks, we will transmigrate your iTunes nom de plume into the credit list of trailers for fake Doctor Who audiobooks produced by Who Back When. Have a poke around our bonus episodes to make more sense of that. That's it. Rock on and be rad and excellent to each other. Catch your ear balls in our next Classic Who Review, New Who Review, or, still funny, Audio Who Review. Ciao.
Who Back When?